It's time to begin our session 333, an update on current events surrounding fundamentalist Mormonism. I would remind you that if you have any cell phones, would you take them out of your pocket, hold them up, and then turn them off? And this session is done by ticket or badge. If you haven't taken care of that, please take care of that with the front desk. Each member of this panel has studied, written about, or closely observed fundamentalist Mormon communities for many years. In this session, they will discuss the latest news about FLDS leader Warren Jeffs, the implication of recent rulings and actions by Utah and Arizona courts, and other current events related to fundamentalist communities and individuals. Our first panelist is Trent Nielsen, is a chief photographer at the Salt Lake Tribune, where he has been for 11 years. Trent is the lead photographer covering the fundamentalist Mormon communities for 1 year. Next we have Brooke Adams, reporter who covers polygamy for the Salt Lake Tribune, recently honored by the Utah Society of Professional Journalists for her work on these studies. And next we'll have Ben Winslow, who is a crime reporter for the Deseret Morning News in Salt Lake City. He's currently covering the manhunt involving Warren Jeffs. Prior to his work at Deseret News, he worked at KSL Radio, the Salt Lake Tribune, and a few other radio stations in southern Utah. He is a recipient of the National Edward R. Merrill Award, as well as Utah Broadcasts and Society of Professional Journalists Award. And last but not least is Paul Tinker, received his bachelor's degree at BYU and his JD at the University of Utah, former chief deputy attorney general for Utah, and a longtime Sunstone participant. We'll give each of these panelists an opportunity, 10 or 15 minutes each, to express themselves, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. If you'll please come up to the mic and speak clearly into the mic as this session's being recorded. Okay. Go ahead. You want to start the other way? They're wanting you. Paul, go ahead and you begin, Paul.
Well, I think probably some of you have realized that the star witnesses that were listed in the program are not actually here due to some unfortunate intervening events, and a lot of us are pinch hitting today. I did not learn about these changes until yesterday, and I had never really planned to make a substantive presentation. We were leaving that to Ken Driggs, who is the consummate student of these developments, even though he lives in Atlanta, has followed the situation here in Utah very, very closely for years, and then Rod Parker, who is actually been one of the litigants recently and has firsthand information. My information and my knowledge is really in the past. So I'll try to put some historical perspective on it, and I would like to throw out a couple of legal concepts and try to maybe illuminate a couple of distinctions in this whole discussion, and then maybe we can pursue those further. Some of you may remember, it's more than 20 years ago now, a Murray City policeman named Royston Potter was living in a polygamous relationship and lifestyle, and serving as a city policeman. And his circumstances came to light, and he got fired. Whereupon he sued the city of Murray and the state of Utah, trying to overturn that firing. And in the process, what he did was allege that the laws prohibiting polygamous relationships were unconstitutional. And what he really wanted to do was overturn the classic United States Supreme Court case on polygamy, which is called Reynolds versus United States. It was decided clear back in 1879. That's the case that said, no, those Mormons out in Utah cannot, under the Constitution and under an argument of free exercise of religion, practice polygamy. It will not be recognized. And that case is well known for its having made really part of our ongoing constitutional law the idea that in religious freedom in this country under the First Amendment, there is a distinction between beliefs and actions. In other words, the court said, those Mormons out there in the West, they can believe whatever they want to about marriage and the celestial kingdom and whatever. They just can't practice that necessarily if we deem that it is contrary to the interests of society. And then the Supreme Court goes on in a whole extended way to tell why polygamy, if practiced, is contrary to the interests of society. Well, Royston Potter wanted to overturn that, and he lost at the Federal District Court here in Salt Lake, and he lost at the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver, and the United States Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal from the Tenth Circuit. And my involvement back at that time was handling the case for the state. So the state essentially prevailed, and the basic idea in Reynolds versus United States, the Supreme Court was not even willing to look at those issues again. To them, it was that clear cut. I had some interesting experiences, though, in dealing with that case, and at that time, of course, polygamy as practiced in Utah, in whatever communities, was not as big an issue as it is today. It was not as visible. Some people talked about it, but it was not so much in the limelight. But the Royston Potter case did focus some attention on it, and I had responsibility in the Attorney General's office at that time, not only for that particular case, but generally the subject of polygamy. This was long before the legislature had funded a task force in the Attorney General's office, as it has in more recent years, to actually do something proactive about those polygamists out there. Anyway, in discussing these issues with particularly with local law enforcement people who had the primary responsibility at that time, if anything was going to be done, it would be local law enforcement people, or in another agency that I was also legal counsel for through the Department of Family Services, they sometimes ran into issues regarding people practicing polygamy. And I found interesting things in trying to help people who were concerned about this issue and these communities try to figure out what they were going to do. For one thing, and I'm glad we have media people here because I think they can comment on part of this. One thing that I tried to emphasize in the Royston Potter litigation and in looking at polygamous issues wherever they might pop up, was that as long as we were speaking in a legal context or about what the law could do in various situations, we ought to be clear about when we use the word marriage. And I took the position that it was not proper to legal discussions at least, to use the word marriage or the word wife in the context of people who did not have a state-sanctioned licensed relationship, but instead had some kind of a religious ceremony or a religious belief or whatever. So I was making a distinction between legal marriages, on the one hand, recognized and sanctioned by the state, and other kinds of relationships, which some people might for themselves term marriage, but which I didn't think we should use the term marriage. And yet I noticed that whenever the media would report on these issues or these kinds of cases, they would use the term marriage and they would use the term wives. These were his wives. And I always had the feeling that that led us into difficulty in how we thought about this, and I'll come back to that with respect to recent developments. The distinction between a state-sanctioned marriage and a religious marriage is one that goes back a long ways. Clear back in the Middle Ages, nearly all marriages in Western civilization were performed by religious authority. That changed with the Protestant Reformation. And in many countries, the power to perform marriages was taken away from the church and given to the state. In this country, we have a long tradition of the real power to establish marriages being reserved to the state, even though religious people may be licensed and designated to perform the actual ceremony, it is still the state, the government, which authorizes the union and which is responsible for the enforcement of the obligations that go with it. It's interesting because nowadays in Europe, it's completely different than it is here. For a marriage to be recognized at all, it must be performed by the civil authority. There is no, in most European countries, there is no delegation of the power to perform a marriage to religious figures. Now, this drives Mormons in Europe crazy because there is no ability to have the temple sealer perform the legally recognized marriage. You have to go to the civil office first and get married there. That's the legally recognized marriage. Then, if you want to have a religious ceremony, i.e. a Mormon temple marriage, you go to the temple afterwards and do that. And that's not discriminatory towards Mormons. That's the way everybody has to do it. And some people are satisfied with their civil marriage and let it go at that, and other people go and afterwards have a religious ceremony. Well, in America, it evolved, and that partly developed because the power had been so great for so many years of the churches in Europe. When there was finally reformation and change, they took it entirely away from the churches. In this country, interestingly enough, clear back as far as the Pilgrims who landed at Plymouth Rock and founded the Plymouth Colony, and who you may think of as primarily a religious community, one of the first things they did was establish that marriages would be by civil authority, not by religious authority. And that pattern continued, but in most states in the United States, it eventually came to be that while the power to authorize marriages was reserved to the state, in other words, the licensing function, the power of actually performing the ceremony would be delegated to religious authorities. And that has its own set of problems, because then you come into the issue of which religious authorities does the state recognize in order to perform a marriage. And for example, in Utah, for years and years, the statute has said by any minister of any recognized religious body, or something general to that effect. Well, in not so much in Utah, but in states like California, it became very controversial. Could somebody claim religious authority in some really way out, offbeat religious group? But anyway, the pattern has remained that in this country, the authority is with the state, but the power to perform ceremonies is delegated to the to various religious authorities or various civil authorities as well. That's a dichotomy that plays into this whole a polygamy issue in Utah. And that brings us to the recent Rodney Holm case, which grew out of Colorado City, and was recently ruled on by the Utah Supreme Court. And I'm not intimately familiar with all the details of how this case developed, but Rodney Holm was a person in a plural relationship down there, who a couple of years ago was charged with bigamy. And I remember reading in the paper when that charge was brought and it went to district court, and he was convicted of bigamy. And I thought, well, that's strange. Bigamy is not really the crime that we ever thought of with respect to doing anything about polygamy and supposed social problems that come from polygamy, because bigamy is based on some different concepts. It is based on the notion, number one, that there is, that this is why I went into the discussion of the authority to perform marriages. Bigamy is based on the notion that there is a state-sanctioned, licensed, recognized ceremony that established not only one marriage, but then also another marriage sometime later on. Those are part of the elements of bigamy. And secondly, the element of bigamy is that second state-sanctioned marriage that was involved was somehow not known by the typically the wife in the of the first marriage that was performed, and was actually to her detriment. Those were the elements of bigamy. And so when Rodney Holm was charged with bigamy, I thought, well, that's a kind of a zealous prosecutor down there trying to do something about a perceived problem, but it will never hold up in the appellate courts, because that just isn't bigamy. Well, was I surprised just a couple of months ago when the Utah Supreme Court said, oh yes, that's a perfectly proper use of the bigamy statute to get after these bad guys. Now, we have a lot of people in this country who complain a lot about activist judges. You know, these activist judges are always going out and finding new civil rights for people, or new rights of privacy that ought to be recognized, or whatever. And you know, those activist judges are terrible people. Well, activist judges really are people who are result-oriented judges, and they want to get to a particular result, whether the law justifies it or not. And that's exactly the way I see the Supreme Court, Utah Supreme Court decision in the Holm case. They wanted to get this guy, and they went through all kinds of contortions to say, well, even though he was only married in a religious ceremony and there is no license and there was no state participation, we're still going to call it bigamy because it was really like a marriage. Now, I don't know where that leads us in terms of maybe other kinds of relationships that are merely established by some religious ceremony or some personal belief, and yet now may be elevated by the courts to the status of a recognized marriage, at least for the purpose of prosecuting bigamy. Now, the court would like to limit it to just that, but I'm not sure that it can be done. Justice Christine Durham on the Utah Supreme Court was the dissenter in this case, and my feeling was that she was the only one who was willing to go out on a limb and risk the wrath of people who would think the court was being soft on polygamy if they threw out this Rodney Holm case. Well, that's some background on how things have evolved over the years and why. One of the things that I did when I had some responsibility in this area was try to encourage the local law enforcement people or the Division of Family Services people who were concerned about these issues, but that they always threw up their hands and said, well, we can't prosecute polygamy. We can't get the evidence. We can't, the juries won't convict. There's a whole litany of excuses of why they can't do anything. And I always said, it's useless to focus on what I would call the status crime, the status of being in a polygamous relationship. Because I think the Constitution of the United States, as interpreted over the years, has already made it clear that that people can choose to live with whomever they want to live with, and there's very little the government can do about it. On the other hand, whether it is a state-recognized relationship with a whole bunch of attendant benefits that go with it, that's a completely different issue. And the state can regulate that. What I tried to emphasize was that people would, if they were concerned about things that were going on in polygamous communities, that they focus on the real perceived injury, which tended to be allegations about children being abused or about government benefits, particularly welfare, being abused. I always said, if those are the problems, then those are what we have to go after, not the status issues. And yet, until the last few years, there's been a great reluctance on the part of local people to make that distinction, and it's often been thought, we either have to go after them for their status crime of living in polygamy, or we leave them alone. That I've never fully understood why that needed to be. I think that's getting sorted out now, and maybe some of what we see in this development will resolve some of that. I may have a couple of other thoughts to add to the implications from the Rodney Holm decision, and I'll do those when we get into question and answers. Thank you.
Hi there, I am Ben Winslow with the Deseret News, and I'm pinch hitting for Ken Driggs. And so forgive me if I don't have any formal presentation here, but very honored to be here. This is my first time speaking at the Sunstone, although I've covered it several times with related subjects. I'll just give you a rundown of what's been going on legally and in the criminal aspect, a lot of this, which is where it's entered this arena. The FBI is still looking for Warren Jeffs. He is on their 10 most wanted list, right up there next to Osama bin Laden. They're looking for him, obviously, for crimes, basically sex crimes in Utah and Arizona, accusing him of performing child bride marriages or forcing teenage girls into marriages, polygamous marriages with older men, and then threatening them with damnation of their soul if they left. That has brought a renewed focus on particularly the fundamentalist LDS church community. And recently, a number of things have happened. It's really hard to keep track. You almost need a playing card just to figure out where things are going. His brother, Seth Jeffs, has been sentenced to probation for harboring a fugitive, being a courier and carrying things to their compound, at least that's what the authorities say, in El Dorado, Texas. There's a grand jury in Arizona looking into financial crimes, possible financial crimes, looking at the school district, the Colorado City Unified School District, where their money was funneled out of there. There's a federal grand jury that's reportedly looking into Warren Jeffs and the FLDS Church. One of his brothers and several other people are currently in an Arizona jail for refusing to testify before the grand jury. We know about Rodney Holmes' conviction being upheld, the police officer. The United Effort Plan has been taken over by a judge in Utah, and is basically being controlled through a court-appointed special fiduciary. The reformation is supposed to take place on Monday, or at least that's what the scheduled court hearing where the judge may announce a decision. A number of things happening in that group as far as what's happening with those people. Other groups continue to remain under the microscope. Utah's Attorney General's office has said they're looking at crimes within closed societies. They even have a special investigator for that. And they're looking into abuse, child abuse, sexual abuse, any other kind of abuse, and welfare fraud, and any of those criminal aspects, although while they insist they're not necessarily targeting polygamy itself. Other interesting things that have come out of this, though, is there's kind of been a pushback, at least from what I've observed. You've seen, while on the one hand it appears that law enforcement has a pair of handcuffs ready to, you know, bring down on somebody, they've got an olive branch. On the other hand, we have the Attorney General's office, who is working with a number of communities forming this safety net committee to reach out and help victims of abuse and neglect and other things within these closed societies, offering them resources that they may not have been aware of before. There have been changes to Utah's emancipation laws. One reason is because of the Lost Boys. Tribune says that recently they don't want to be called that anymore. So there's been laws changed for that, to help them be able to emancipate themselves, be able to get social services, be able to get education if they so desire, and because they've been kicked out of these communities. There's also been more of a push for equal rights for plural families. There's a lawsuit that's going to court in Denver this September, Bronson versus Swenson, which a lot of polygamous communities, particularly pro-polygamy activists, are feeling that this is a really good shot at changing some of the laws. This is a lawsuit where a family sued the Salt Lake County Clerk's Office over the right to be husband and wife and wife. And that lawsuit is going to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver this September. In a lot of ways, a lot of these things, at least from my observation, this push for equal rights for plural families is very similar to the gay rights movement, which is interesting. It's sort of politics making very strange bedfellows. But it is, you know, it a lot of ways it mirrors it with legal actions, with protests, with things like that. It'll be very interesting to see what'll happen in the next little while, but certainly the profile of all of this, all of the things that have been happening, has been raised with Warren Jeffs. I mean, we even had a story this morning that in our paper that Jacqueline LeBaron, one of Irvell LeBaron's daughters, has been added to the FBI's most wanted list for her role in a series of murders that were carried out back in 1988. She was indicted in 1992 and hasn't been heard from. And so as an effort to kind of renew the case, they've just added her. So a lot more profile has been put on a lot of these groups. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Brooke Adams, and this is Trent Nelson. We've been working as a team covering polygamy for the Salt Lake Tribune for about 4 months, or since February. Time gets away. It's a year. It seems like many. I have been covering polygamy a little bit longer than that. I began to write about it for the paper back in late 2003, when a number of events began happening in the FLDS community in Hilldale and Colorado City. And frankly, at that point in time, I went to one of my editors and said, you know, it looks like we're going to have a Hatfield-McCoy sort of thing going on down there, as the Barlows and the Jeffs began to take each other on and seemed to wrestle for control of that community. That didn't happen, and that was almost even more surprising that as Warren Jeffs began to exert his control over that community, many, many men left silently. And so that created another intrigue. I would agree with Ben. There are sort of three tracks that are going along on the polygamy front right now. There's a criminal track, there's a civil track, and there's a social track. The social track is an attempt through the Attorney General's Office Safety Net Committee to reach out and bring social services and try to loosen up some of these closed societies as far as educational, social networks. There's a civil track, which is the takeover of the United Effort Plan Trust that has operated in this community forever. So in this community, this is a picture of Colorado City and Hilldale, and virtually every piece of property within that community is owned in this United Order Trust, and that is in the process of being broken up. What will happen tomorrow is the judge will reform this trust and set it in motion where eventually the people property will be individually deeded to people. That's the ultimate outcome of that process. There's been an interesting tug of war between the people in this community and Bruce Wisen, the fiduciary managing the trust now. They sort of, as the court and the state took over the trust, put up a silent protest and refused to pay their taxes, which we've written many stories about, and they began going house by house to get people to pay their property taxes. And they began hunkering down in this community as well. A lot of fences and no trespassing signs began going up in the FLDS community as hordes of media. I think there's a new media in town there every day and sort of being rather intrusive too, I have to say. I just got a call last week from a Swedish reporter who had come all the way to document what's happening in this community. So they've sort of pushed back by trying to erect tall walls, try to put up all these signs, keep people out from peering over into their life there. One of the men who's down there working through the Arizona criminal side of things is Gary Ingalls. He's an investigator. He is the one who put together 8 criminal charges against men for taking underage wives. I'll use the word wife in this context, plural wives, in that community, and we just had the first successful conviction of Kelly Fisher in those prosecutions. And those cases are sort of interesting because I think if you look back now in hindsight, the Arizona Attorney General had received birth certificates, so these were paper cases in which they tried to prove these allegations of that women were giving birth to children who were minors in Arizona. And in Arizona, the law is you cannot have engage in sexual conduct with anyone under the age of 18, which is interesting in a way given all the teen activity that goes on there. But so they took on these men for taking plural wives who were under the age of 18. That case sat at the Arizona Attorney General's office and they couldn't get anywhere in 2002 timeframe. And Warren Jeffs, ironically enough, sort of helped give them the opening to take on his own community by kicking out men who then began to speak out about what was going on within the community. So now you had not only, you know, the paper documents to build this case, but you had witnesses who would speak about, in some ways, what had happened, what was going on in the community. And it's also at that point in time that the states and the plural communities, as I understand, there were sort of a friendly conversation, and there's people here I think who could answer that better than I can or describe this. But some communities agreed that they would ensure that underage marriages didn't occur. This is a community that refused to let the government dictate in their mind how marriage could occur in their community. And there's some pretty fascinating sermons we've been able to get a hold of and are posted on the Tribune website where you can read what these people themselves had to say about how they were going to view what the government was about to do. This is just a picture. When you're in town, sometimes they have, you know, a security system of their own that's off the legal end of things that will tend to follow Gary Ingalls around everywhere he goes, and so he's being followed here as we're with him. A cat and mouse game is underway there. This is an example, again, of the sort of sheltering that is going on there. Another wall, children playing. This is where Bruce Wisen, the fiduciary, made his first tax stand. This is a 64-acre compound in which the brother of Warren Jeffs lives. There are, I can't remember, 23 homes or something like that in there. He first posted this home to break the logjam on getting taxes paid in that community. If you've never seen what the homes look like there, it's sort of interesting. This is another example of what a home looks like. Many of the homes there are rather unfinished, but people do live in them, and some of them that I've been in that are unfinished can be very nice on the inside, and some are not. Have had different explanations for why homes look this way. One is that people, there are no mortgages, nobody has a mortgage here. You're given a piece of land and allowed to build a home on it, but you do that as you can. You know, you don't borrow money from the bank to build the home. The other explanation that's given why they're left in this state is that it lowers the tax value. So you pick which one you want. This is Andrew Chatwin, who was hired by Bruce Wisen to post tax notices on a home. And that's what he's doing there. And as soon as a notice would be posted on a home, people would pay the taxes. So it worked, I guess. This is another example of the kind of home building that goes on there. You can see a small functional home, and then they're expanding it for the rest of the family. This is Rulon Jeffs, who was Warren's father and preceded him as leader of the FLDS. And there's another familiar LDS person. This is Richard Holm, who has been in the news quite a bit. He is one of the men who was kicked out by Warren Jeffs. And how that happens is, you know, these men are told they have committed some unnamed sin. They need to figure out what it is, let him know that they are repenting of it, and they're told to leave the community and go repent from afar. When this happened to Richard Holm, these are two of his wives and some of his 17 children. He was told to leave without his wives and children, and he did. And he went away and tried to repent and couldn't figure out, could never get on track with Warren Jeffs about what it was that he had done wrong, and lost his wives and children. So his wives were assigned to his brother, and his children were assigned to his brother, and he did go to court and fight to maintain his parental rights in that community, however, so he's sort of forced visitation on his children there. He recently, one of the other things that happened, you know, when a man's kicked out of this community, they lose their home as well. Some men are now being able to go back to the fiduciary and petition to reclaim the homes that they built in the community and at least be allowed to live in them, if not have the deed to them at this point in time. So Richard has just moved back into Colorado City, into the home he built and lived in with his family, which he likes because it allows him to be a little closer to the children that he's trying to see. Some of his children will talk to him, many won't. Warren Jeffs tells people to not talk to what he terms apostates. So it's a very difficult situation for the families down there. These are the children, 39 children of Marvin Weiler. And you know, if you wanted to look to one family that's been sort of instrumental in trying to speak out and to give information and help government do their thing in this community, it would be this family. Many of the children who are like Ross Chatwin, Ezra Draper is married to one of Marvin's daughters. Isaac Weiler. Yeah, Isaac Weiler. All of these names that you've heard about in the news are children of Marvin Weiler. One of the things that's talked about is education in this community. Is there a school? Is there not a school? Yes, there are schools there. We've seen it when we're in the community. I have been told there are more than 20 private schools in the community. This is a picture of recess at one of them. So they've taken over what used to be the Phelps School building there and are using it for one of their private schools. Many of these schools are organized by home families. Some of, like you would have the Holm School or the Barlow School. We don't know which one this is. If we were to... Oh, it's the new Alta Academy Jeff School. So that's an interesting thing, and we get an incomplete picture there. Many of the Lost Boys who come out say they were, the children of diversity, say they were stopped going to school at eighth grade or so. But we have talked to children. There's another girl who just came out of that community who was in 11th grade there. So it's a very mixed story about, and I don't know what the true story is yet there. One thing I have been told is they have no... They do have a block, and you're not allowed to go to college, which is interesting. And the person that told me this, who was an FLDS member, I asked them, well, isn't that sort of short-sighted? You know, he was telling me that they had previously been allowed to send children and people to college, but that was a thing of the past, and they weren't going to be doing that anymore. And it just seems like a very short-sighted plan. And so education seems to not be valued in the community, a higher education that we think is necessary to run a community. Boys and girls are kept separately. These are girls playing at recess. These are high school girls who were at school. I think they're high school. They look to be at least junior high. Again, mixed question about education in this community because, you know, we could see these girls in the play yard, so to speak, of the school. And what happened, when you're down there, of course, they're not very friendly to outsiders and particularly probably media. So these girls were playing in the field, and as we drove by, they pulled into this circle and turned away from us, and they got tighter and tighter and tighter and put their heads down as we got closer and closer. So children playing. A lot of times, you know, when people come into the community, if they see us like this, they take a look at us, they would run and hide. Just more scenes. This is the meeting house, the Leroy Johnson meeting house there, which has not been used since. One of the things that happened as Warren Jeffs began tightening his control on this community is he stopped people from going to church meetings, and not quite sure why. So this building virtually sits empty. As I understand it, families now meet as families and hold church meetings that way within the community, but there are no large gatherings of people, except we understand this building was just used the other day for a funeral. So maybe in small ways they're beginning to use it again. That's Leroy Johnson's grave. One of the great mysteries you'll hear a lot about, there are a lot of rumors that go along about this community, and one of the hardest things for me as a reporter is that many of the people you're trying to report about will not talk to you. And so you know you're only hearing part of a story, many of it filtered through people who have an axe to grind. And so one of the little rumors is about the baby cemetery, where some people have asked the government to go dig up all the baby graves because there's allegations people are killing them or there's, you know, whatever. So we went to the baby cemetery and saw a very different story than had been reported to us previously. This is a long-standing cemetery with the kind of burials in it that you would see in a community that has a lot of children. We went up to Canada. The FLDS have an outpost in Canada that was split in 2002 when Winston Blackmore was ousted from the church by Rulon Jeffs, who many say was acting at the direction of Warren. This is a view of his home and some of his children in Canada. That's Winston crouching down there. It's a very pretty scene there in Bountiful, as it's called. More children. This is from the Kelly Fisher trial that we just did in Kingman, Arizona. There are 8 men, as I mentioned, facing these underage marriage. He was the first to go through this process. It was interesting to watch the jury selection down there. They brought in 150 people, and many, many, many had to step off because of their opinions about polygamy or their exposure to things in Colorado City. Nevertheless, he was convicted of, you know, sexual conduct. And it really wasn't a question whether he did it. He acknowledged he was the father of these children. His name is on their birth certificates. He acknowledges her as his wife. They are still together. They now have 3 children. It was a question of whether the government could prove where it happened and Arizona had jurisdiction to charge him with these crimes. But he wasn't too happy with being photographed one day. But we are very persistent, so we eventually get it. We offered to give him a bigger book next time, actually. So, this is a new monument that was just placed in a Cottonwood Park in Hilldale, Colorado City, commemorating the 53 raid. This is an event in the lives of these people, as well, many other fundamentalist families around the state that sort of shapes who they are, how they interact with society, and how they view government. And so this monument replaces one that Warren Jeffs had destroyed in 2003 when he was unhappy about worshiping icons. That's why he had it destroyed. Okay, thanks, and we'll take questions.
If you have questions, please come up to the mic here, and we'll pass this mic down if you want to direct questions specifically to any of the panelists.
My name's Gary, and I'm a fundamentalist Mormon. Been in the principal, 12 kids. I have a statement, and I'd like Mr. Tinker to respond. Mark Shurtleff is pressured from time to time by anti-polygamy advocates to apply more pressure to the polygamous people and communities of the state of Utah. And he's definitely done some of that, but when he's asked to put more pressure on, he comes back with three excuses which I think are lies. And the three excuses he gives are: there's no place to put all those tens of thousands of kids if we go in and raid all those families. The second excuse is it's really, really hard to get witnesses to testify against these people who are in these fantasy relationships that Lawrence doesn't criminalize anyway. And the third excuse he gives is that they don't have sufficient law enforcement resources in the state of Utah to go after those people. And I believe that the reason these excuses are lies is because the Lawrence decision of June 26, 2003 says that states cannot enact or enforce any legislation against any consensual adult sexual conduct. And he also knows that the last two bigamy cases that he pressed forward ended up in Supreme Court appeals. And so don't you think that the reason, truthfully, that he isn't prosecuting any more adult consensual polygamists is that it hands them a slam dunk Supreme Court appeal?
Well, number I need to make clear, I can't speak for Mark Shurtleff or anybody else presently in the government. I have not been in the Attorney General's office myself for well over a decade now. So I'm not speaking with any authority or anything like that. I don't know whether those are just excuses or not. I used to say somewhat the same things, although perhaps not quite the same way. The first one you mentioned reflects our collective memory of what happened at Short Creek in 1953, when the then state governments of Arizona and Utah went in and raided those communities and took all kinds of kids and put them in foster homes. And it was a horrible mess. It didn't work. It was a bad idea to begin with. It shouldn't have been done. And I think most reasonable law enforcement people have thought since then that we ought to be careful about doing that sort of thing again. I mean, good grief, if we don't have the buses to send all those 11 million illegal immigrants back to Mexico, we're also not going to have the places to put all the people that would result in being homeless or in distress from wholesale raids on these communities. And that's one of the reasons, as I mentioned, that my position always was, let's not get too focused on the status of these people and their relationships. And I should add the caveat, when I said that, I meant I was talking about consenting adults. I was not talking about children. Children are a different issue, and I think most law enforcement people will agree with that, that we are talking about different things. Now, you can argue as a matter of public policy what the age of consent should be. And in this country, the age of consent actually varies from state to state, and that causes problems. And it would be better if we had a national consensus on what the age of consent was, either for sex or for marriage. But we don't have that, and that causes a lot of problems. But as far as consenting adults are concerned, I agree with your implications about the Lawrence case. It really means that consenting adults can do pretty much what they want to, and the government has no business getting involved with it. And I think that's the way our society is evolving. As far as the second point that you said Mark uses as an excuse, it's hard to get witnesses. I think historically that has been true. If you are talking about trying to prove a marriage or a relationship that is not documented, because within the only people who would know about it typically would be people in the same community, and those people were unwilling to talk. As our reporters have pointed out to us, that has changed somewhat recently, at least in the Colorado City community, because of some of the things that Warren Jeffs has done, and I think that has pushed some people to be more willing to speak. The resources question, you know, government people always use that excuse, no matter what. They always use that excuse. And so I sympathize with your point on that.
My name's Chris. I'm from St. George. I've had the opportunity on two occasions lately to work within this community as a hospice worker, but strange bedfellows. Just recently, as a gay man, we had the opportunity to do a letter writing campaign about the recent legislation regarding children and adoption rights and those things. And it was interesting, when we got together, there was about 15 gay members from St. George, and about 15 to 20 women from Colorado, from Centennial Park. And we got together and did this great letter campaign. So yeah, it does make strange bedfellows.
I've just noticed it more and more, and I've even talked to members of the pro-polygamy activists who've made that comparison as well, and they're using Lawrence versus Texas and other, court decisions. It's just something I've observed more and more, that it's almost like they're on the same track.
And they're very open, and I was very surprised at that, because you come in with your own biases, and these women, it was just the women too, which I found interesting, but they were very informed and very open. My question is this, though, with the long-term effects, as anybody talked about that, meaning that if the United Order is dissolved and Jeffs is then found, what is the long-term effects, do you think, of this community, as they now no longer, their property is owned individually, Warren Jeffs is no longer leading them, what then happens to that community?
Well, one thing, can you hear me? Okay, one thing that Bruce Wisen anticipates, if the court does approve the reformation of this trust and sets it up, the spendthrift trust, which is the mechanism by which people would be able to get the property deeded to them, is that the FLDS people will not cooperate. Just like they did not cooperate until sort of forced to the mat on the taxes. And so if that's the case, that sets up a pretty interesting dynamic in that community, because the people who will participate are the apostates, so to speak. So it's sort of, in a way, I think of it in my head like Revenge of the Nerds or something, because they're coming back in and taking control of the community again. So I don't know. I mean, what we know now, a process has been underway in this community since 2003 to move away. And Warren Jeffs has apparently told people, too, that he's through with Short Creek. Don't know if that's true, because there are still quite a number of people there, and it seems sort of like when you're down there that it's business as usual in many ways. So I don't know if they will all leave that community or not, but now that they're in Colorado. They have a place in Colorado. They have a place in Texas. They have a place in South Dakota. They've moved into Nevada quite broadly. One of the things, and so to me, it's also like a ball of mercury, and the government's put its thumb on it, and it's just split off into a bunch of different directions. And I'm curious about how that will make it for government in the future to keep track of this, because it's going to be much more, this community anyway, is going to be much more diffused and hard to find.
One of the first things that will happen is if Bruce Wiesen gets his way, is you will see the privatization of property, which they, at least from the lawyers and the court-appointed special fiduciary's perspective, is this is a good thing because people will have individual property rights. Recently, a woman down there called Bruce Wiesen up saying that she had her husband had died. He was part of one of the original cases that went to the Utah Supreme Court about property rights in a united order, and she, as I may have this a little bit wrong, but it's like you own the home, you don't own the property it sits on. You don't own the home either. Okay, or do you own the equity, or?
No, you are living there. You're a tenant at will.
Tenant at will. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get there eventually. And but her husband had died. And the question was, what would happen with her? Because it was until you died, basically, and she lived there. And so I think that's still being worked out at this point. But I think what will happen after Monday is really anybody's guess. It's going to be quite interesting, as Brooke said, to see what happens with the people who are FLDS faithful and then the people who are living in the community who are, you know, not or are no longer in the church or in the club.
You know, maybe just one more little thing on that. They have one of the things they're trying to do, and it's a really tricky thing for the state, and I'm curious to see how they pull it off. They had to get around the aspect of polygamy, frankly, in reforming the trust, because they had a line in there that said something like, you agree living on this land that you will abide by all the laws of the land. Okay, well, what about the fact that most of the people living there are living plural marriages? So they've now worded some language in there. And government, I think, was in a dilemma because they couldn't, you know, you couldn't have the court sort of sanctioning that. So they've tried to word some language in it that gets them around that they will, you know, have respect for all religious beliefs or something like that. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. The other problem that they have is when they set up these trusts, they don't want to deed the property to people they think will just turn around and give it to Warren Jeffs. So they want to still have some control and micromanage, in a way, what rights people have, you know. So it's really a much trickier situation than we're describing it here.
We're definitely oversimplifying it.
Recently, Mary Batchelor and I were on a call-in show headquartered out of Philadelphia. It's Your Call with Lynn Doyle. And during the time we were on being interviewed, they conducted a survey, and the question was, should polygamy be legalized? At the end of the program, they announced the results, and we were very pleased and surprised that 53% of those that called in said yes, they thought it should be legalized. A similar thing happened out with a radio station in Logan, Cache Valley, where there's 80% Mormons. And they did asked the same question as I was being interviewed during the program, and the result came back 54% thought that polygamy should be legalized among consenting adults. Do you see a trend here outside the state or even inside the state where more and more people are willing to accept it as an alternative lifestyle and that there's a possibility that eventually it could be decriminalized long term?
Short answer, I think no. That's a long shot, frankly. There's a new study that just was presented Friday at the American Psychology Association by a researcher out of Georgia Southern University. And he had 2,400 people participate in his self-selected survey. And in that, he found very little support for legalization, actually. So that's kind of a surprise there. The Kinsey report actually asked a question about polygamy as well, and in that survey, you know, which is the long ongoing social survey of sexual attitudes and habits in America, and in that, I didn't realize this was in there, but I was told by Sally Gordon, who wrote The Mormon Question, a very detailed and wonderful book about politics and plural marriage fundamentalism over time. She pointed out that in there they found too that 90% is the number there were opposed to legalization. So I don't know, you know. And here in Utah, One of the interesting things that this guy out of Georgia Southern found is that if you know a polygamist, then your attitude towards them softer, and or towards plural marriage tends to be softer and more accepting. And this is generally a Utah phenomenon. So if you're talking about across the country, I don't know. On the flip side, outside of the country, you have a lot more acceptance of, you know, all kinds of adult behavior. So.
Well, Islam also practices polygamy. It's taught in that too. So I think outside the United States there's a little bit more. And then I think also as you see that population increase in the United States, you may see kind of a change in philosophy. But it's also, you look at it from another point of view too, is it's also a political movement as well. It's not just a, you know, lifestyle. It's become politicized. And so as you see, I think that, you know, it's true. As you talk to more people or you know someone who is a, you know, polygamist, then, you know, your attitude maybe changes about them, you know. But I also, you can't help but look at it more of on in terms of a political thing. The more you, like, you were on these radio shows, that had to have been an effect from people listening at that particular hour. Now, if you took somebody randomly on the street and just started surveying them, I'm sure you would get a completely different response. But I think it was just more from exposure to your point of view or what, you know, you were telling them on this radio show that they responded that way.
Well, and one of the factors that that plays here in Utah is not only are we closer to the to experience with real people, real living people, but many of us, most of us probably, even though we don't have any current involvement with the principle, all our ancestors were, and we have a natural sympathetic voice that comes out occasionally because of our ancestors. I think that's natural. Quite frankly, I think that's a little bit of where Mark Shurtleff comes from sometimes. Let me broaden this part of the discussion a little bit, though, and become a little bit philosophical. Yesterday, in another session, I think it was the HBO Big Love session, and you were talking about these same issues, and you said that that your position was basically that you would like to see polygamy decriminalized, but not necessarily legalized. I think that is a very logical and defensible position, and I will give some reasons for that. The Lawrence case, as has already been pointed out, pretty much makes crystal clear what was already well developed in our constitutional law, that consenting adults in terms of their relationships can do pretty much what they want to. But there's a difference between what consenting adults do in private relationships and what they do in state-sponsored relationships, namely marriage. Because the institution of marriage brings with it a whole host of legal obligations and benefits, all the way from inheritance and consent to medical treatment and things like that that are essentially private, but also to government benefits, Social Security and tax dependency and exemptions and immigration status and all kinds of things like that, that the government has an interest in defining how those benefits may work between individuals. And what Western civilization has said is that those benefits work on a one-on-one basis, one person to one person at a time. Now, the issue, of course, and this has been mentioned in other sessions, well, we have the gay issue coming up. What about same-sex marriage? Can it be, can we eliminate those old traditions that say that one-on-one relationship can only be with a man, between a man and a woman? Can it be between two people of the same sex? Well, I think that the same-sex marriage issue is a little easier to resolve on a legal basis than the polygamy issue is, because it's still a one-on-one relationship. It does not change the numerosity of the participants in the relationship. And if you want to remember a key word whenever this discussion comes up as to whether the polygamy issue and the gay issue are going to go along the same track in our society in the near future, I would resort to that word numerosity, because that is the difference between those two issues. Polygamy is talking about a numerosity in the number of participants in a legal relationship that confers benefits. The gay marriage issue is only talking about the same number, i.e. two, one-on-one. That has always been the case, and it only changes with respect to whether they have to be opposite gender. I tend to be very sympathetic to your point of view that our society is almost on the verge of decriminalizing polygamy, and I think it would be a good thing if we did. I think it's a stretch, though, that in any of our lifetimes, either the courts or the legislatures will establish a legally recognized polygamy where all the benefits of the state-sponsored relationship of marriage would apply to multiple partners. I just don't see that.
That's why we don't really encourage legalizing, is we don't want, we meaning most of the people I know, don't want more than one legal marriage license. They value their religious commitment ceremony more than they do the legal one, so they would not be involved in the legal setup or restrictions.
And I think that's a good point to keep in mind whenever we have these distinctions. I was glad that Ann clarified that in the session yesterday and again today. Thank you.
I think one thing that's underestimated is the derision faced by the polygamists. For example, outside the Kelly Fisher trial, outside the courthouse, the local population just has a real disdain. And I think a lot of the point that you, Anne, I've heard try to make a lot, that is a valid point that really people don't understand in America, is there are so many different polygamist groups and so many different directions they all take. But as long as Warren Jeffs is receiving the amount of attention he is, everyone's guilty by association with him. He is the one, his behavior is how all polygamists are judged right now, and that may be very incorrect, but that's how the American media and the American people see it. And I think it's going to take a long time for people for that to change. If you look at the gay rights movement and its progression, it takes a long time for people to come around. And like the study that Brooke mentioned, I believe that what was it, the acceptance level doubled if they knew a polygamist, is that what it was? So I mean, that's a huge number, but it's gonna take more than big love for people to turn around.
I'm actually from England, and so I'm fascinated by some of the ironies that I learn about, you know, from having moved from England and to come here to America, because where I grew up, there's a lot of socialism and liberalism in England, and it's getting stronger. And so when I came to America, I thought, you know, this was the land of the free, and I'm wondering if I've discovered otherwise. But one thing that I do find an enormous irony is my children, when they go, all my children go to public schools. And if a teacher in a public school in my children's classroom were to say something like, black people are low class and ignorant and they shouldn't have the same rights as Caucasians, that teacher's job would probably last about another 8 minutes. That would be the end of that teacher's career. If that teacher said, gay people are filthy and wicked and evil, and what they do is a sin, then that teacher's job would last 8 minutes. And my children's teachers regularly say disparaging things about polygamists in Utah, and there's no repercussion whatsoever. It is politically correct in Utah to disparage us, and that is why decriminalization ought to happen.
And that's why the Utah Supreme Court upheld the Rodney Holmes case.
you know, just following up on that a little bit, it's interesting now that this public rally that's scheduled for next Saturday has been announced, that's going to involve youth and families from the fundamentalist communities, to see the backlash against that. Because it sort of seems like, you know, the activists who are opposed to polygamy in any fashion, and much of the public have one view, and it's a very difficult thing to shift the view and to let yourself look at it from a different angle. And so many people are feeling and are expressing great antagonism that the idea of these children coming forward and or families coming forward and speaking out about their lifestyle. But they don't have a problem if it's the boys criticizing it. So I don't know.
I've got one quick question for you, Brooke. You said that they don't want to deed the properties in Colorado City to people who will give it back to Jeffs. Isn't the whole point to give the people and let them do whatever they want with it? Isn't it to say, this is yours, you don't have to share it, you can keep it, you can sell it, you can give it? Why should the government have control over them when they don't want Warren Jeffs to have control over them?
I don't know the answer to that. but you know, that is an expressed point of view of the people trying to figure out how to reform the trust and do it in some way that in their minds it can't just revert back. I think there is a big question about that, because, you know, on the one hand, you want to treat people, the whole point of this is to supposedly free these people so they can make their own decisions and act like adults and all of that, but then they don't want to let them do that. You know, they still want to manage them because maybe, you know, they see them as still children in a way who don't know any better. So I don't know. I don't know how they're going to deal with that. And I don't even know if and I'm not a lawyer, I don't know how you can do that legally, you know, put restrictions on it, like set it up to be property and free right, but then control it. And so I don't. So, you know, but you know, the problem here is those people will not challenge that either. They have a stated position that they are not going to challenge what happens here. And I've asked some people there, how do you feel about this trust, you know, falling apart? Because frankly, it worked very well for them generally up until the court took it over. The taxes were always paid. There were some issues with people who got out of favor with the leadership that were booted out of their homes, but a mechanism through the courts had been set up to give them lifetime estates. Taxes were always paid, people had homes. If you go there and you look at this community and you go back and look at coverage of it in the 80s, it was a different place, you know? It was quite a remarkable community in a way. So it's sad to see how quickly, and there's a parallel for this, frankly, with Jim Jones, actually, how a religion can be functioning and be working well and take a very sudden, terrible turn. And if you know the history of Jim Jones, he served on community boards in San Francisco, was highly respected, had an in with the mayor and all of that before his troubles began. So it's kind of sad to see what's happened in this community, frankly.
What was it that turned him?
Government pressure. People, a similar thing, you know, people began speaking out. He had a turn, the unhealthy turn in some ways, where he began telling his followers that, sort of commandeering some of his followers, frankly, kicking out and treating very harshly and brutally some that he didn't think were correct. So government began to look at his actions at that point. That's when he retreated to Guyana, and things took the turn they did.
That's a good example to think about and to ponder at the philosophical level, because that's a recurring theme in American history, is when does government properly interfere with a religious community? What are the boundaries? And I think Short Creek is a good example that the government doesn't do very well at figuring that out. And that's why I often advocated great caution in how the government should. And that's not to say, by any means, that the government should ignore objective harm being caused to individuals, particularly children or particularly other innocent victims.
My question, Brooke, is a little bit to you, but also to Mr. Tinker. I know that you and Ben have covered the men that have been arrested and put in prison for refusing to testify before the grand jury. And there has seemed to be some effort to not make that information available or to, I don't hate to use the word cover up, but it's, you know, these men are being held without any charges basically because they refuse to testify. And what are the legal ramifications of that? How long can they be held? And what happens after that?
Well, it's this will be interesting to compare comments here on that, but to me it's sort of one of the scary things about the American justice system. This is perfectly legal. So people can go to the grand jury, be called as witnesses, and if they refuse to testify, they can be put into prison and held there for the term of the grand jury. The grand jury that's there in place right now in Arizona's term will not expire until March. There are five people that we know of right now that are being held in the detention center in Florence, Arizona. Some of them have been there as went into prison there in April, so they've been there that long, and there is no public record that they are there. The only way that you know, have been able to figure this out, is in the beginning we got a couple of names because they had been called to testify and they didn't come back, and so people in the community talked about it and their names came out. The next group of men that we heard about was just little, got a tip about it, that there was some more men that were in jail. But if you were to call the, unless you knew the name and you called on the right day, you could not find out they were there. There's no court record, there's no court paper, they're there forever. And when the next grand jury comes in, they can be reinstituted in that. And you know, the parallel for this that we all know about more publicly is the Barry Bonds case, where his personal trainers being threatened with contempt as well. That's a big public event. And in the media circle, you could talk about Judith Miller. So the only way you know about these people that this is happening is if family or, you know, somebody connected notices they're missing or some other way that it comes to public attention. And I just think that's a question for the legal system, that they can do that. Because if it can happen to them, it can happen to you. And I think there are probably hundreds of people that could end up in prison there who probably know nothing about where Warren Jeffs is, which is this seems to be the focus of this grand jury, and could give no insight about how things are working. And one good example of that to me is Micah Barlow, who's a very young cop from Hilldale in Colorado City, a flunky, if you will, at the very lowest level, who I just can't imagine why he had got called in and what they think he might be able to provide for them. Other than out of a sense of loyalty, they are not going to talk about their church or their leaders. So,
the grand jury is a very problematical aspect of the American justice system. Grand juries are intended to be a safety mechanism, by and large, when the regular law enforcement process doesn't work for some reason. They are supposed to be a way to get around a local prosecutor who doesn't, who for political reasons or whatever other reasons may not want to act, and so forth. You have another avenue. You go to the grand jury. They're different in every state. There are many variations, and so it is a little bit hard to generalize. But because of their special nature, because of the fact that they aren't used that often, they are subject to some very difficult problems and issues. I have not followed this particular matter at all, other than what I've seen in the newspapers and the comments that have been made here today. But it, just speaking in general, this is a significant issue. Civil libertarians in this country ought to focus on this kind of issue, regardless of who it is that's being held for indeterminate periods and without charges and so forth. It really should be looked into, and it's difficult. It really is. Fortunately, grand juries are, in most states, are not used that often, but they do have real problems because they do have these special powers to hold witnesses and so forth.
But actually, this is a federal grand jury that they are being held for refusing to testify before. And so it raises a lot of similar issues, but this is... Florence is a federally contracted private prison.
Okay, yeah, it would be the same issue, and it's similar in the federal system. Grand juries are used in special cases, in unusual cases. Not by no means everybody who is prosecuted by a federal prosecutor or in federal court has been before a grand jury. They're used for special purposes, and they do have problems.
Yes, it does.
Well, it seems to me that this is being used as a mechanism, and maybe rightfully so, but to scare the hell out of the people down there by taking
the
individuals.
You're shaking the trees. You're getting them to talk.
And just taking these people away, and they're gone, and nobody knows where they are, and they're just gone, and they're not charged, and who knows when they're going to get out.
They're charged with contempt of court. They are being held on contempt for refusing to testify before the grand jury.
Right.
And if you look in the court system in Arizona, there's no record that says these people were charged on this date by this judge for this crime. It's not there. It doesn't exist.
Think it's a unique alternative way of basically trying to really intimidate them without coming out with a raid.
But I think that the question that has to be raised also is if these people aren't talking, this grand jury is still active, it makes you wonder, though, who is. You know, and they're probably for, you know, these many people that aren't, there may be a number more who are.
Well, I think everybody understands that the best remedy that we generally have in this country for abuse of governmental power is the power of the press.
That's right. We're the judge, jury, and executioner.
No, but you should be able to track this. You know, you should be able to say so-and-so has now refused to testify and is in prison and track what's happening to them and where they are. And, you know, frankly, in this community, they're very close to each other as well. And so when we reported the names of these five people that are being held, most people in the community didn't know that. It was a shock to them, too. And so... you know, and you have to think about the implications to the community, too, if, as some people have said, there may be 100 people's names on subpoenas waiting to be served on people who may end up in jail, and what the impact is on families, too. So,
and don't forget the grand jury could be extended as well. So this could go on beyond March. The government could go in and subpoena all the Colorado City town marshals and thus take away the police force if they didn't, you know, testify. So this is a could be a real tool in the hands of government in the way they see they need to, you know, do what they're doing. So.
And when it comes to finding people, though, to issue a grand jury subpoena, the trick is catching them and serving them with the subpoena. And they've tried it numerous times in that community, the FBI has, and it's been met with not much success so far that we know of. But then again, the FBI doesn't really say a lot either about what they're doing.
Well, we want to thank our panelists this morning. I think this has been a lively discussion. We regret the absence of Ken Driggs and Rod Parker, who were scheduled to be on this panel. But because of legal issues that they were involved in, we're unable to be here today. But thank you for your attendance.